This is the final apex drum, 8,196 words. It's 10 inches long and about 8 inches in diameter. My father manufactured a large number of these things, many of which came to the States. I suppose some of them caused trouble, but I must say that we had one which ran for about 10 years, and we didn't even clean the dirt out of it. So obviously they would work under reasonable conditions. Next one, please. This is a picture of the Apex machine. You can see one of the big drums on the bottom. This is Hilary Stinton, who was an engine I had at that time. We'd improved our teleprinter equipment, and that was the input-output console. That was a picture taken at Birkbeck College in 1952. Next one, please. I'm not going to describe these in detail, but this was the instruction code of Apex, starting with the stop instruction, as it might be conceived totally appropriate. I show this for one reason only. When we designed machines, we arranged that each higher machine in sequence had a code which was compatible with lower machines in sequence. So the ARC machine had a code which was compatible with SEC, except, of course, that SEC didn't have a multiplier and divider, and the Apex machine was compatible with everything we'd ever done before. And the later machines, the M2s and the M3s, were compatible with these. I think there's a great advantage in doing that. But, of course, when you've only got something like 16 instructions, actually 32 positions available for instructions, it's perhaps easier to do that than when you've got 100. Next one, please. Well, we're getting to the end now. Very dingy colour slide. This was the machine MAC, which we had eventually at Birkbeck College. A very pleasant machine to work with, very, very small, nice and compact, extremely reliable. I don't know what happened to that machine. I suppose it got tossed out when I left the college. But that was the lab. Notice the harking back to Princeton days. This particular slide was 1955, but the cooling was primitive. It was an old fan mounted on the stool. In fact, it wasn't even a decent fan. I remember the engineers knocking up the cage to prevent catching their fingers in the blades. We couldn't afford to buy proper fans. But there's the machine, and that's the sort of programming material we had with it. The next one, please. That is a machine which we called M2, and I made a number of these. Used to keep the lab going by making one and selling it to somebody. The M2 basically followed Apex design, except that it had a somewhat different drum, the one with the track, which would store 32 words of immediate access storage, a flatter drum and shorter than the other ones. It also ran at higher speed. Tape reader, our own design, and a tape punch, 100 a second tape punch, which we also designed in the lab and which we manufactured for some time. I show you this machine. This picture was taken at the University of Saskatchewan. I brought one of these over with me. We built a transistorized version of it in 1972-3, and I gave this machine then to Moose Jaw Technical Institute. My understanding 2 years ago was that it's still there and working. So if any of you want to see what a 1950-type machine looks like, and you don't want to leave this continent, you could go to Moose Jaw Tech. I've never been there, but you could go and see if you ever want to. Well, that was the M2. And I think that's probably the last slide. Am I right? Yeah, last one. Thank you. Well, that roughly is the history of my own involvement in computing machines. As you know, I've become involved in somewhat different things nowadays, although I still try to keep an interest in the field. We just recently have connected a small PDP-8 type machine to a scanning electron microscope for work on the recognition of chromosome abnormalities, which is a field I've been interested in for some time. My current interests are more in the applications of computers in the biomedical field. But I congratulate those people who've come after us, and particularly the people who designed the little baby computers, so that I can now do rather more than I did with ARC and SEC with a machine which I can take around in my pocket. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions.
Brainerd of the Moore School of the University of Pennsylvania. I would like to make a comment on several of the statements made and then to raise a question. I trust I jotted this down properly verbatim, but the speaker said, I do not know whether MIT would have created a digital computer at that time or not. Let me say that in my opinion, and according to such criteria as some of us have gotten up, the answer is no. This question has arisen often. It seems to be almost automatic. Why didn't MIT do it? For very good reasons. Of course, it was tied up in digital. But I knew Caldwell up there very well, but I also knew others in the EE faculty. And they were all, and we have good reason for believing this, as MIAC is concerned, they were all they all believed that the digital machine was impractical at the time. Another question I'd like to ask is the Dick Snyder who's being referred to here. At Princeton, there are the RCA Laboratories of Princeton, New Jersey, the Princeton University of Princeton, New Jersey, and the Institute for Advanced Study of Princeton, New Jersey, no one of which is connected with the other. Dick Snyder, that I knew, came down to the Moore School from RCA very shortly after the war, a year or so. He immediately showed me his binary counter made up of magnetic units. So the statement it wasn't working at the time is probably true, but I'm not sure that it meant very much because he had it going very quickly. Question I'd like to ask is, there was a reference to the MIT Pulse Handbook. I'd like to know what that is. I followed most of the publications at that time, and that doesn't ring a bell with me.
Well, the book concerned was called the MIT Radar Handbook, and it was in those days a large book with a blue cover.
Oh. You mean the book that was entitled Ultra-High-Frequency Techniques?
No, that was a different one. That was a thinner book. Now, this was a book about 2 inches thick.
That's what I'm talking about.
The Ultra-High-Frequency Technique was a totally different book. I know that one as well. That wasn't anywhere near as good. incidentally, I would agree with you on the Bush-Caldwell thing. I think we must have got a different Schneider. Because Dick Schneider, as far as I know, didn't work with magnetic cores, and the counter I was referring to was a hot tube counter.
James Tuck, Los Alamos. I'm so glad you mentioned that ancient computer, the Abacus. I think it's the first time it's been mentioned. My first contact with the Abacus was with Nick Metropolis's Maniac. I remember just by the door there was a glass-fronted case. Under it, it said, in case of emergency, break glass. And you know what was inside.
Jan Reichman, RCA. Since Dick Snyder is being mentioned, he happened to be a colleague of mine at RCA Laboratories, and the arithmetic unit that he mentioned was developed at the laboratory. It was a DC coupled circuit, and it was a set of DC voltages, two sets of DC voltages for the anode and the organ, and the sum appeared as another set of DC voltages. It was also in those days that we developed resistive matrix memory, and all of these things, to just set the dates right, were made in 1939, 1940, before any of the present were underway.
Yes, I think I should agree. The resistive memory I was talking about was the one with burned holes in paper. The resistive matrix was quite well known. It was state of the art in 46, which is the first time I was involved with it. I would agree with you. I should perhaps just tell a little story, which doesn't take a moment, connected to some extent with RCA. I think it was on the occasion when I visited Jan Reichman with Zworykin. It was at that time, I suppose, the big white chief. I was taken home for some reason by Zworykin in his car. And being a simpleton from the UK, I hadn't recognized the great advantages of US technology. We drove up to Zworykin's home, and he pushed the button of the horn on his car, and mysteriously the doors opened, and he drove into his garage, and then we got out, and I said, well, this is wonderful, I suppose that's all automatic, you see. And he said, I'll tell you, is you're one of us. So I said, oh yeah, what? And he called, he beckoned, and a large gentleman, I suppose it was his butler or something, appeared from the side, and he said, no, he has to stand there when I have visitors and open the door when they turn up.